Good morning and welcome to a regular commission meeting of the Chelan County Board of Directors. It is April 30th, 2018. We have three commissioners in the room right now, and Commissioner Congdon will be joining us in a little bit. And then Commissioner Arsenault will join us by phone for our afternoon meeting. At table is Steve Ryder, General Manager, Teresa Boucher, Acting Clerk, and our attorney, Eric Walquist. And please do what is necessary to silence your cell phone. And if there are people who wish, and we encourage you to do so, to address the commission, please do so. State your first and last name, your address, and plan on using a reasonable amount of time, and we can adjust that as we need. With that being said, I'd like to introduce to you Court Hill to do our Pledge of Allegiance and our safety meeting.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Bring a little spring fever to the boardroom today. This coming month, May, is National Bike Month. And so if you haven't already guessed by my attire, I'm here to speak to you about bike safety. So I have a few tips before your next bike ride. Tip number one, check the weather forecast. Avoid riding a bike when street surfaces are icy. Be extra cautious in rain. Visibility for both the bicyclist and the vehicle driver is impaired. Wear your helmet. Notice the emphasis there. Take the time to ensure that your helmet has the proper fit. Should be secure, the strap should be secure, you shouldn't have a lot of loose room. Remember, a poor fitting helmet is as good as no helmet at all. When you need it, it's needed. Keep your bike in good mechanical condition. Wear high visibility clothing at all times. Try to make sure no one misses you on the road. A good jacket like this is helpful, particularly in the cold. Avoid riding in the dark, but if you do, wear clothing with reflective strips. Have a blinking light on your rear, a headlamp on your front, and reflectors on the wheels and pedals. During a sunny day, like we're hoping to have here next few months, wear a good pair of sunglasses. It's helpful to keep the sun out of your eyes, but also the bugs if you're riding around the loop trail. I'll take them off so I can read you. A good pair of gloves is recommended. You never know when you're going to topple over, and the first thing to go down is often your hands. So a good pair of bike gloves to protect the palms of your hands. If you're wearing pants, make sure you wear a tapered leg pant. If you don't have tapered legs, then if you have a straight leg pant, do something to clip off your pant leg. Where you can tuck your pant leg into your sock, or you can pull a rubber band up over your foot and up your ankle and close your pant leg. If you're wearing shoes with laces, tuck the laces into your other laces so that they're not hanging out and liable to get caught up in the gears. If riding on streets, obey all traffic laws and be extra cautious. Ride with the traffic, not against it. At busy, uncontrolled intersections, get off your bike and walk it across, preferably at a crosswalk. Use good communication techniques with vehicle drivers, such as eye-to-eye contact and hand signals for turning. if riding the Apple Capital Loop Trail, follow the posted rules. And last but not least, if you need any help with your bike or clothing, visit one of Chelan County's premier bike shops. We have many. There's bike experts that are eager to help you.
Court, thank you. Any comments, questions?
I just think that that was really good and timely safety tips, and it brought back interesting memories of when we used to do a bike safety for the elementary school kids at Cashmere Rotary and do all the bike repair that you're talking about, make sure they were safe. You know, there's a lot of kids that ride bikes, and we want everybody safe.
Yeah. I may have missed since I just walked in. I had to do a radio thing, but I'm just curious. I just bought a new bike helmet, and my new bike helmet actually has kind of an inner kind of soft frame inside this hard shell, so that if you do get in an accident, you can, you know, you can, your neck can move and you can get movement inside without coming up against a hard surface. I know they've done that with football helmets as well. So, yeah, they're much safer.
Yep. Technology is fast improved over when I was a kid, so they keep, helmets keep getting better and technology gets better.
Do you ride up to your park in Antioch and back?
I've not ridden all the way to Antioch back, but I do ride around here. I enjoy riding to work.
Notice I said his park.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Court, thank you very much. Appreciate it. I was giving him a bad time about his casual dress showing up at a board meeting, but I guess it's appropriate today. Thank you. Looking at the approval of the agenda, I have had a suggestion that Resolution 9 be moved to the consent agenda. So looking for information from the commission as to whether that's an appropriate thing to do or not, or any other changes or additions to the agenda.
No objections to the movement.
That's works great. For me.
Okay. So we'll move Resolution 9 to the consent agenda. Let's move then to Mr. Steve Wright and the quarterly district performance plan update.
Let me introduce it quickly and just say, of course, we've been doing these quarterly performance plan updates for a number of years now. This is the end of the first quarter, and normally you would expect everything to be green or blue. This year we have more reds and yellows than we're accustomed to, and it really is a function of what we've been talking about for months now. The overwhelming amount of work coming in as a result of dealing with cryptocurrency loads is already having a pretty big impact on our performance on the district performance plan. So that's what you should expect to see today. We will do this as we normally do. We'll go through by exception, and we're going to start with Mike Pullman.
Good morning, commissioners. Mike Coleman, managing director of fiber and telecom. I have to admit that I hate being up here first, because that means I have a miss on the first item. We came up slightly short in the first quarter. We had an expansion goal of 200, and we hit 151. That was a result of delay in resources for boring, which meant that we couldn't make those connections till after we got the boring done. We are reasonably comfortable that we will catch up and stay on our goal.
How'd you arrive at 200? Just based historically, just looking back at how many you've been able to do, or was that a stretch goal? Or
no, it was an educated guess that takes into account the work that we have planned and the timing of that work, when we get started, how much we expect to do on a daily, weekly basis. So there was some forethought put into how we spread the goal, and we also have to look at, of the work that is planned, how many premises do we pass with that particular work, because they're not all equal, and that's why you see 200 in the first quarter, but we jump up to 640 in the second.
Oh, okay.
And we don't count them until we have light going to them.
Thank you.
I've got the next item, and it has to do with developing the 2020 to 2024 district strategic plan. This one is actually on track as of this point. We had a certain amount of work we wanted to get done on the educational piece that we put out at the beginning of that. That is on schedule right now. This is really more a worry about if there was something that was going to fall off the cliff in terms of work that's coming up as a result of the cryptocurrency load. This is probably one that would move. But we are intending to have something available under the schedule, at least planning to have something for the board review by third quarter, and today we're on schedule for that.
Commissioners, Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services, Objective 1E on page 1. The Public Power Benefit Program is behind schedule a bit. We will propose adding unallocated funds to 2018 projects and suggest 2019 project funding on May 14th as far as the introduction and then action request of the board on June 4th. Next one's also mine. It's on page 2. It's Objective 1H, the Chelan Gorge Trail. We continue to work on route design with the Lake Chelan Trails Alliance and the City of Chelan. As a result of that, that's delayed the permitting, but that's going very well.
Okay, good morning. Steve Grenard, Director of Central Maintenance. I'm filling in for Kirk Hudson this morning. The first two I'll cover on page 3, Objective 2H. Item 1, B6 returned to service by Q1. It was actually returned to service the first week of April, which is a week or two late. It was under testing. It actually went commercial on the 15th of April at 7:15 in the evening, producing megawatts for the grid. So good news there. Of course, B7 had to wait. The next item, H2, B7 had to wait for that unit to get back in operation before we took it out. And it is fully being disassembled at this point for modernization.
I'll just note, we have a overall review of what's going on out at the hydro units coming forward in the next month or so. Just there's a lot of activity going on and a number of things that that we want to share with you.
Good morning, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director. I have the next one on page 4. It is L1. It's under our asset management approach. We had a goal to assess alignment when looking at things like feeder hardening, capacity improvements, the National Electric Safety Code compliance, and conjunction with the fiber build-out to develop a recommendation to kind of take all this together and as we move forward in the next year. We've spent the bulk of our time developing standards and application processes, which is really the front end for a lot of the NESC compliance aspects, as well as we've had key resources dedicated to the HDL effort and the moratorium.
Commissioners, I have the next item. It's M1 on page 4, the Fiber Asset Management Program, specifically selecting the asset classes for strategy developments by Q1. We missed the March 31st due date due to resource timing and priorities. We, however, did complete it the first week in April. We showed it as red, but it is now complete.
Mike, can you, for my benefit, would you tell me what an asset class is?
It is looking at the assets that are within our infrastructure and placing them into specific classes that define a category of equipment or a category of asset, because there could be specific action items, maintenance schedules, et cetera, that are directly associated with those assets.
Okay. In my mind, I was thinking you were selecting which classes you're going to attend or something like that.
really, it's...
When you get a board of all that.
in our case, we start with a hierarchy, and we work from the node into the core. We look at the specific classes of equipment and the different assets, and we have to make decisions on whether it is an item in and of itself or it is a particular item that has subclasses. It could be a big box with many different types of cards in it. Mm-hmm. And so we have each one of those identified within the hierarchy.
Great, thank you.
I have the next one on page 5, and this is under the goal R2, and this is around regionalization of the Upper Valley water, wastewater. This the genesis of this came from a public power benefit request. This was turned over to the city of Wenatchee the city of Leavenworth to administer, and it included Cashmere, Peshaston Water District, the county, and the PUD. Our goal was to do a readout of the report by the end of Q1. We did not hit that goal, so it is red. However, just recently, last week, a meeting was held with the stakeholders involved in that process, and that readout of the report did happen. I believe Commissioner McKenna was there with Ron Slava.
And I think, John, all or commissioners, I'll reserve my feedback and comments till commissioner report and talk about that a little further.
Okay.
Okay, I have the next one on page 6, item V1. Item V was hardened transmission system to protect against fire and weather. Item 1 was complete the Chelan-Manson transmission line option analysis by the end of Q3. Transmission engineering, their workload has shifted primarily to the high density loads, and it's so it's basically a workload issue for them to get to it, so that one is running behind.
Still on page 6, objective 2W, long range facilities planning. The implementation is underway at Rock Island. In fact, you'll hear a report on that later this morning, while negotiations for the Port District for property continue.
I have the next one under 2X2, and this is around distribution planning, siting of construction projects. We had a goal to determine the priorities by Q1 and implement a strategy for the next locations by the end of Q3. It is currently a yellow. Frankly, again, there has been a lot of the folks who've been dedicated to the HDL large loads have been pulled into that. However, I would also recognize that it has provided an opportunity to do a lot more front-end legwork with some of our municipalities in the county to hold discussions and kind of engage them in that next round. So although we're not where we want to be, I think we bear greater fruit at the end of this by just having that engagement.
Next one is item Y on the same page. Execute 80% of the capital plans on schedule and within budget through the year. And generation and transmission, we're behind mainly due to the lagging progress on billings at Rock Island modernization. I'm covering this for the entire group, by the way. So everyone's group are running behind on getting the billing done and the projects completed at this point.
Just because of so much work and
yes, ma'am.
Just overloaded.
Everyone's expecting to catch up.
Yeah.
So I think we'll be fine.
Steve, I don't want you to get away without saying good to see you. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for filling in. Not that I don't appreciate our usual actors.
Thank you. This is Andrew Grissell filling in for Greg Carrington. Going over items, G, page 9, from objective 4, 1 through, let's cover 1 through 4 right now. And then, so these are all items associated with electric markets development going out and reviewing energy imbalance market work. And they're all postponed due to the work of the cryptocurrency work. And so we have team members that are associated with all that work, analysis and those sorts of things. And so those have been postponed. Still we'll be working towards them, but the timelines are pushed back.
And I've got the next one regarding Columbia River Treaty. The first item in particular is a risk. That's the issuing of determination notice. The State Department representative has indicated to us that they're not likely to issue the termination notice in their term. They want to begin the negotiations and see how things go and then make a decision based on that. We continue to feel the same way we have all along, that just because there's a new person there doesn't mean the facts on the ground have changed. So we'll continue to articulate our view, but at the moment the State Department is not in agreement with us.
And then working under items Q, page 11, 1 through 3. Again, these are all, these are implement longer-term strategic marketing plans to address changing energy markets. And as we have had this new inundation of interest from a retail perspective, as well as the extra work that our staff has been working on with the cryptocurrency, these items have been pushed back as well. And it's going to be similar for items T, 2, and 3. These were develop a large retail customer development plan We need to understand that more, what's going on out there in more detail before we can come up with any sort of plan for looking at that. So.
So I have the next one on page 12. This gets into the metrics and targets on objective 5. It's E, it's on the wastewater O&M, cost per ERU. We've exceeded what was forecasted. We were a little over $1,100, and this primarily is driven by a reclassification that was done last June, but because this metric is a 12-month rolling average, it carries into this year.
Commissioners, I think the next one's mine at G1 and 2. This is implementation of the governance risk compliance solution. That project is moving forward and is still currently on schedule. However, we've shifted it to yellow to recognize that there is an ongoing conversation between the district's implementation team and our contract counterparties about shifting the implementation methodology from a quick start methodology, which really is sort of an install it, get up, get your hands on and use it, the way I typically think of learning a software program, to a more traditional implementation model. And that's a conversation in part led between our two contract counterparties, Enablon and Standard Model Partners, just trying to evaluate the best way for our staff to provide the input it needs, get the program here, and I'm going to say installed in a fashion that will meet our needs and get us working. So we're modifying that potentially slightly, and that's the reason for the change.
And good morning, Commissioners. Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer. And I have the next item in the middle of page 13, around advancing our data analytics and business intelligence capabilities. This primarily stretch goal is contingent on us filling the open positions that we have for this discipline. We have three open positions currently. One is completely filled, one is interviewing, and then the other will follow. So we do anticipate two of the three to be filled by Q2, but we do think that will influence our timeline for the remainder of the year, so a little bit slower than anticipated. And then also of note, though, is one of our pilots, data pilots, was in the safety reporting area, and we are a little behind in the completion of that, but we recognize that the data was not staged in the ultimate way that it should be for long-term foundation for building upon our data analytics. And so we took the time to make sure we did it right, because getting that first layer and foundation right is really important to this really important discipline we're trying to develop within the organization. I also have the next one, turning on to page 14. And this process improvement to improve the way we value our capital projects to help us with selecting what are the right projects to do as we're doing long-term planning and budgeting. This process improvement will be foregone this year due to the, you know, resource requirements for large load. And this is one of those where it's the process improvement is needed at the beginning of the process to be able to use it through the process. So if you can't do it at that timing, then you need to forego it for the year and pick it up again for next year. Mm-hmm. So we'll use a similar process to last year that we used for these, and then we'll pick up the process improvement again for next year. So this will remain red through the entire year.
Okay, Commissioners, Mike Coleman, I have the next item. On page 14, item P2, which is the microwave system replacement project, and it continues on into page 15. Items A and B, the factory acceptance and equipment installation in Q1 and Q2 was delayed, therefore it's red. What happened there is during the factory inspection, factory check of the design, there was a design change discovered, and therefore it delayed the schedule. So it's all been slipped one quarter. We are still expecting the project to meet its ultimate timelines. That also affected item three there, system disaster recovery feasibility, because of the resources being tied up in that extra system design change, then that was delayed from Q1 to Q2 and is also red.
And good morning, commissioners. I'm Lorna Klemanski, Managing Director of Human Resources and Safety. Turning to page 19, under Objective 7A, the metrics, 2 and 3 are not as good as our targets, and we did set some pretty aggressive targets a couple of years ago, and we've been chasing them ever since. We are on an improving trend, and I feel pretty good about the fact that we're as good as we are considering all the work we have going on out in the project. And then item A4 was a tactical error, I would say, in terms of making this target a little bit more difficult to reach this year, just at the same time that we were having all of this additional work we were doing out in the projects. The same people who are doing that work are the people who are the ones that implement the changes we need to meet the safety recommendations. So our target last year was 75%. We moved it up to 80%. We are meeting 77%. So all in all, doing well, but not as well as we had hoped.
Still showing growth, and but not the amount that you'd like to see.
That's correct.
I'll just wrap this up to say, at this point, we're hitting about 83% of our targets. So those are the things that we didn't talk about. That's lower than we would anticipate in first quarter. On the other hand, I think you'll see when we get together on May 14th, we've made some pretty substantial progress in terms of understanding how to address cryptocurrency loads across the board, from energy to distribution to transmission. We know a lot more about our system than we knew a few months ago. So we have some good progress that's made there that doesn't show up on the district performance plan.
Yeah, I just have a comment. I think I asked 2 weeks ago, or maybe a month ago, maybe it was Lindsay Mons, I forget who, I asked if this large load, the large load resource requirements were affecting everybody's, how much it was affecting everybody's workload. And wow, this demonstrates just exactly how much it's affecting everybody. I mean, it showed up maybe 20 times in here that it's been delayed because of large load work requirements.
And I think when we get to May 14th, you'll get a better feel for that, because you'll see the product of the work that is being done now, and how it's affecting all the different parts of our organization.
Be ready to move on then. And to all of you, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And, I share what Commissioner Congdon was just saying, but also know that staff have been probably busier than ever. And it's a good, hardworking group of people. And when things settle down with crypto, I know we'll be back in track, because those same people are going to be as productive in their current assignments as possible. So thank you all very much, and please convey to your employees that you work with that our confidence in them and what we're all going through. Appreciate it very much. Quarterly energy report, resources up.
I can invite Jan Jaspers and Andrew Grissell to give us the quarterly report on energy resources.
Good morning, commissioners. Janet Jaspers, Energy Planning and Trading Manager.
Andrew Grissell, Manager, Energy Development and Conservation.
And we're not requesting any action of the board today. And we're going to cover kind of our normal areas, portfolio overview, some operations and planning information, market update, and then lastly, Andrew's going to finish up with the energy efficiency update. Just to try to save time here today, we're just going to highlight what's changed since our last time that we came to last quarter. So our district load resource balance really has not changed. We have not implemented or executed any new slices. Our market positioning has not changed since our last quarterly update. Then we're going to switch to river flows. And our monthly river flows have been quite a bit above average. So we're looking at 113% of average for the first 4 months. Looking out for the water supply forecast, and this one is from the Northwest River Forecast Center for the Grand Coulee Dam. And this chart shows that we're January through July, which is the time period that we track. We're at 122%. I looked up to this morning, and it's showing 121% of normal. And kind of switching to temp and precip. So on the left, you see the chart for precipitation. And EC is equal chances of above and below normal precip for the time period April through June 2018. On the right, we have temperature. And for our area, we have equal chances of above and below normal precip, so looking pretty average. Sometimes our friends to the north, the Canadians, have a little bit different outlook. It, this is the Canadian forecast for March through May. If you look at BC and the state of Washington on the left, we have white for precip, which is kind of normal precip forecast for those months. And then over on the right, we have temperature, and we have white, which is, again, kind of normal temps forecasted.
Janet?
Randy, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you don't have to go back a couple of slides. My question goes back a couple of slides. In my mind, 122% stream flow at Rock Island Dam now through September. Based on historical knowledge, what does that probably produce as the likelihood of some of our parks being underwater for some of the time, maybe in June?
I'll probably have to get back to you on the answer to that question.
Okay.
The STP forecast, which I did look at not that long ago, has up over 200,000 flows. And Grand Coulee has drafted quite a bit, so we're in pretty good shape for the amount of snowpack that we have. But for those exact statistics, I would have to check that.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's been periodic times when we've had parks under, some of our parks underwater a little bit.
Janet, on the discrepancy between the American forecast and the Canadian, is that probably or not the model that is utilized or just a different way of looking at the data?
Probably a combination of both.
Okay. Yeah, just curious. It's, you know, because there's, truth is always interesting in terms of the view, you know, so. And I'm not accusing anybody of anything. It's just how do you derive that view? But thank you. Yeah.
Do you have something more? So Janet, maybe this will be for another day. But with 120%, 122% of average. So what are we looking at for spill? Are we going to be looking at a tremendous amount of spill, and then gas, and then the issues with exceeding gas? You know, numbers with our spill.
Yes. So the answer to your first question is yes. We're in spill mode. We have units out at both of the projects, and so the amount of water that we're getting on a daily basis is above the hydraulic capacity at both projects. And so this week, I think we're getting about 175,000 CFS out of Chief Joe plus side streams, and so both projects are experiencing the spill. And so far, we haven't had total T TDG told us all the gas issues yet, but I'm expecting as the flows increase, we'll probably actually get into that area.
Mm-hmm.
We are doing everything that we possibly can to minimize total dissolved gas. And so at the projects, we actually spill kind of across the whole project instead of open one or two gates.
Mm. So you're saying we average that?
Yes.
Average so that number?
Kind of a flat spill across all of the spill gates really is how mm-hmm. we have at Rock Island some of these notch gates that reduce the amount of TDG that we're adding. We put minimum generation on the projects, which goes out to all of our participants. A lot of times we purchase or carry reserves elsewhere at the shipment or other systems. And so there is a lot that we're already doing to minimize the impacts of TDG.
Didn't I read somewhere that the Department of Ecology is considering or has adjusted those gas numbers because of this conundrum we're in where, you know, you have to spill other projects are facing the same issue.
Yes, and so with our water quality standards, I'm looking around the room for someone who is a better expert. So we do have a 7Q10 flows, and so it's I think it's right around just above 200,000 KCFS at both projects. And so if the flow is above that, then you kind of get a hall pass that says, okay, we realize that the flow is well beyond your hydraulic capability and that there's really not much you can do. And so it's not technically, I think it's an exceedance. So. But I could check back with our water.
Yeah, I just remember reading something. So is that fairly new, the quote, hall pass from Ecology?
No.
So no?
They've established that 7Q10 flows for both projects.
It's been a while. Because I remember getting waivers back at least 10 years ago. Yeah.
At least 10 years.
Oh. Yeah, I'm just curious if there's been any change or if they've relaxed that in any way or are proposing that. I thought they'd. I read somebody's proposal.
Several years ago, they looked into that, and I didn't follow the outcome of that, but they had looked about increasing those
numbers.
But I'm not, I'm not sure.
So that hall pass gives you a pass, but for a limited period of time, right? I mean, I'm sure it's not for, for the whole spring season.
Just basically, an acknowledgement that when the flows are so much beyond your hydraulic capacity of your plant, you're going to be spilling. And so there's, it's kind of beyond your control. You can't do much to minimize TDG at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, thanks.
Jen, I was with a group of people the other day that asked me a question that I couldn't answer. So in one report we get that we're 112 or whatever percent of snowpack, and yet there was a report that came out just a month or two ago, I believe it was from NOAA, that talked about the snowpack for the last 100 years has continued to decrease each year, and they were questioning me on, well, if the PUD's reporting that we're at an average, what is that average? Where is that average taken from mathematically? How long does that go? Or,
So the Northwest River Forecast Center has 30 years. And so right up in the top, we have a 30-year normal. So it's basically, I think it's underneath here. So that 30-year normal is 59.6 math. So this green line across here would be equivalent to that 30-year normal.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of a moving average, right?
Yes, and so they, when there's another decade, they drop off the oldest decade at the newest decade, so that data set is moving and updated.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Steve just raised an interesting question, and definitely doesn't need to be answered here. And how difficult would it be to reach back and look at a bigger average for us as a utility to see if that number that we're talking about truly is diminishing. And I, you know, I know you can't answer it here. But,
okay.
You know, because we've probably got 60 years of knowledge.
We probably have better tools and techniques, more accurate today than we did 30 years ago, I'm sure.
Yeah, the Northwest River Forecast Center definitely does. And so this chart is for Grand Coulee. So I don't think Chelan PUD would have a data set for Grand Coulee, but I think our data set for the Chelan Basin is probably as good or better than ours. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay. And we're moving on to electricity prices, and which are somewhat related to natural gas prices. Last time we were here with the last update, natural gas was $2.71 per million BTU. And so for this update, it's $2.67, so just a decrease of 4 cents. There were some increases and decreases in that time, not just kind of a straight 4 cent loss, which makes it look pretty volatile on this graph. But if you take the graph and look back from 2002 instead of this graph, this yellow box is just the area that we showed on the last slide.
Wow, that's great to put it in perspective like that. Yeah.
Okay. And now looking at mid-C flat annual electric wholesale electricity prices. You know, we've kind of talked about the wholesale market price falling. And so if you look at 2018, it's kind of the lowest historically that you'll see since 2000. And so at budget time, back in November 2017, the kind of flat price for 2018 was $22.76. On April 10th, it was $18.90, so it had dropped $3.86. Then, looking at that, it's a forward curve out through 2023. And so for the 2018, you can see the price, well, the annual average flat price dropped $3.86, but kind of in the first 2 months, you can see from the dashed blue line to the black line, dropped quite a bit, and again, kind of at Q2 time frame. Later on, in the out years past 2020, really prices haven't moved too much. And then looking at the 2018 net wholesale revenue and other energy-related revenue at budget, we had budgeted in total $116 million, or $116.3 million, and now our forecast is $116.9 million, so up about $600,000. And it just kind of shows that our hedging program really insulates us from in-year price decreases. You know, your drop close to $4 per megawatt hour, you would think that that would really drop, but we had sold up pretty tight coming into the year, so just kind of shows that hedging program at work. Then looking at the net wholesale revenue forecast out through 2027, you can see in 2018, really not much movement. If you look at the blue line versus the black line, it's this kind of aqua blue solid line, which was our last quarterly update. And now we have the black solid line, which is this quarterly update. You're beginning to see some decreases starting in 2019, and those are related to our load forecast being quite a bit higher than it was last year and last quarter. And so 2019, 2021, we've seen roughly about a 15 megawatt increase in our load forecast. And so there's just less power to sell on the wholesale market. Going out to 2027, the decrease from that aqua kind of blue line to the solid black line is due to close to a 40 megawatt load increase, load forecast increase. Switching to Lake Chelan elevation, and so the green line is the current year. You see a dip here. It's when they were actually doing maintenance on the gauge. It's not real, thank goodness.
That'd be a pretty dramatic drop. Yes.
And so, actually today our elevation is 1088.5, and tomorrow's our May 1st target. The May 1st target is 1087.6, so we're almost a foot higher than the target for May 1st. And expecting to fill kind of in the middle of that orangish peach line. Then just some market highlights. Everybody has been kind of interested in the Western energy imbalance market. Earlier in April, PowerX and Idaho both joined. And then in this coming year or two, we're expecting the balancing area of Northern California, Salt River Project, Seattle City Light, and LADWP. On the right, just highlighting some of the solar records that have been broken in the last couple of months. Peak generation, solar generation hit an all-time high of over 10,000 megawatts. So pretty high. Then they hit two more records. So lots of solar coming on the grid.
What is LADWP, do you know?
Los Angeles Department of Water and Power.
Okay.
I'll turn it over to Andrew.
Thank you. Slide is our quarter one energy efficiency results. As a reminder, our two-year compliance target is 2.42 average megawatts. That was set last fall by board action, so based off of our conservation potential assessment. We also have our annual 2018 stretch target, which is 1.7 average megawatts. First quarter, we're at about 0.4 average megawatts, and this is really good considering Q1 is typically very slow, and so we're just about on track, you know, spread out evenly if we acquired evenly over the year, which we usually don't. And so we're real happy with that. Some of it's due to we have some new commercial programs coming online, including a commercial web-enabled thermostat program, which we hope will lead to a potential demand response pilot project. And so we're working on getting those installed and coming up potentially with that. Also, just wanted to give a brief update on the streetlight project, the LED streetlight project that we've been working on. Right now we're concluding with the drafting of the interlocal agreements, the lighting agreements with the cities. We have received confirmation on the funding agreements or the grant agreements from last year, approximately $700,000, and we're ready to go with the project work itself. And so we're getting closer to moving forward with that project. It's still taking stepwise and doing all those things, and so we still need to get full agreement with those lighting agreements. So we'll be working with the municipals on those. So in summary, our net wholesale revenue and our specified source energy sales are just over $500,000 higher than at budget, the forecast. And then as we're moving forward with our energy efficiency projects, we're on track to meet both our compliance and our stretch targets. So that's, I think, for questions.
No, I just want to add one thing. Normally at this time of year, we'd be bringing you one of the annual slice sales, and we're not. this time around, in part because of the uncertainty associated with cryptocurrency load. But we're also reasonably well positioned because last year we put in place the Avista sale that starts in, or excuse me, the Avangrid sale that starts in 2019 and the Avista sale that starts in 2021. So we are fortunately well positioned, but at the same time we are pausing as we think about future slice until we get a better understanding of where we're going with cryptocurrency loads.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be 0.6 up for budget. Always good to see.
Next up, Mike Coleman and Bob Fain are going to give us an update just on, they've been thinking a lot about long-range technology and how it can impact the fiber broadband program, and wanted to share with you what they've learned from that.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom, and with me is
Bob Shane, Director of Network Operations.
So today we're going to talk about the long-range technology plan. In our update back in the fourth quarter, we had mentioned that, and there was some interest from the board, and we said we would come back and talk about it a little bit more in detail. So with that, we go to why are we here today. We're going to talk at a fairly high level. What is a long-range technology plan, otherwise abbreviated as an LRTP? Much easier to say. Talk about why we need an LRTP. What does it look like? Some practical examples in the use of it and the results and the conclusion. And really, we want to focus on what it does for us, what are the benefits to the district from executing a long-range technology plan. So when we look at what is a long-range technology plan, it's a lot of information and data. It's really designed to allow us to achieve the greatest asset benefit that we can. It's a forward-looking assessment that looks at both the short-term, 1 to 2 years, mid-term, 3 to 5 years, and long-term, the 5+ year views. It's a very adaptive and changing set of documents because we're looking at the changes in technology and the trends that are impacting the way we use the technology. But more importantly, we're focused on how does it allow us to meet our financial and operational expectations. It is an agnostic perspective. It's very important to us that we not get hung up looking at just what we're using today, the manufacturer, the type of technology, et cetera. We're looking out beyond the technology. We're looking at different vendors and even at a lower level, looking at different products to create solutions from.
So why do we need a long-range technology plan? The answer is pretty simple. We want to operate and maintain our system in the most cost-effective and efficient manner with real-time, ongoing assessments. And we're going to talk about three examples in this presentation to help illustrate the benefits of the long-range technology plan. But as we go through this, I want to list some of the high primary needs for why we are using the long-range technology plan. We want to make informed decisions. We want to focus on the outcome and the objectives. An example, we'll talk about how we manage our bandwidth needs later on in the examples. But essentially, we want to manage to maximize the life of our electronics, the fiber plant, while keeping the system at a competitive advantage in cost, reliability, and service offerings. Factors that we constantly consider would be product cycle life, the technology operational complexities, O&M cost, the flexibility and adaptability, and the ease of management of these systems. We need to identify any disruptive and augmenting technologies. And what we're talking about is looking at down the horizon to see what's just beyond or on the horizon that could materially impact our business unit, both good and bad. We want to determine the velocity and the probability of fruition. Some of you might remember we did a power line carrier technology assessment many years ago, and we also did more recently a wireless proof of concept to look at those technologies. We'll include the technologies both at the component level, that is the smallest smallest common level of the system, the upper intermediate system, and then enterprise. That is a completely different type of technology. We want to plan for system upgrades and replacements. There's a lot of options to consider in maintaining and operating the systems to meet the district's customer owners' expectations while leveraging the existing infrastructure to produce high value and long-term benefit. Sometimes we repurpose the equipment, that is, we use it differently in our system. We consolidate, we look for incremental advantages, including deferment of the upgrades. One key importance is the timing of the execution so we achieve optimal benefit from our assets at the right time. We don't want to adopt something too early and pay a higher premium for it, yet we want to implement that soon enough to realize the value of it. There's also some increased operational efficiencies. We look at technology investments in other areas other than the network. We look at things such as materials and equipment tools for improving crew safety by reducing their field and time in the field.
So what does an LRTP look like? The Long Range Technology Plan is really a repository of information. It contains technology roadmaps, standards, guiding principles, and other information that's related to our network. It's both documents that we generate as well as documents that we collect either from subject matter experts, outside the organization, consultants, and vendors. What it's doing is documenting how we will fulfill our mission and achieve our goals in the near, mid, and long-term future. And it's providing us a decision framework, and all of those decisions output, they feed into our asset management program, our forecasting, and our budgeting processes. And it also encompasses all the tools available to us for network management.
So I mentioned a couple examples. We'll briefly go over those. We looked at applying technology in the sense, would it be disruptive or is it an alternative to our broadband systems? If you recall, we did a wireless proof of concept about a year ago. We evaluated our needs against our expectations. We applied our institutional knowledge as SMEs. We are very much aware of the industry trends and where wireless was going and how that could be possibly disruptive. A particular interest was associated with the FCC opening up the radial spectrum to enhance broadband services. And that resulted in quite a bit of advancements in the wireless technology industry. So we were looking at that very carefully. The bandwidth management I spoke about, one such application that was coming online was the IPTV, that is television over the internet. That has a tremendous impact on our bandwidth requirements across the entire network. So as we replaced our OLTs, that's our shelf. If you remember, we used terminology of BPON and GPON. Those are the systems that we had to upgrade. There are some logical things in doing and replacing those, but we always took into account the product's end of life. Was it becoming obsolete? Didn't want to spend money on a system that was going to quickly or eventually go obsolete in the near future. We noticed that some of the systems we were looking at, although they had adequate bandwidth capacities if you invested, it had a relatively low cap, and so to invest in that may have been a short-term hit, but in the long run, you would have lost the ability to expand. Anytime we did upgrade, we were always looking at getting the best value and benefit. The timing of those platform replacements is very important. So right now we're at the latest platform, which we call the 7360. That's the latest GPON. The great thing about that is it's the latest technology. It has long-term bandwidth capability and expandability. It has technology advancement, such as MPLS capability, which we won't go into here. But it's just another added feature that we could use in the future to manage our networks. And it has, right now, the capacity to serve up to 10 gigabits per second on the subscriber side. When we talk about the outside plant, there's a lot of moving parts. We have hundreds, if not thousands, of splice cases out there. These are labor-intense devices that you have to get in to do the splicing. So we're looking at technology and advancements in those products. So you have fewer moving parts. There are better quality seals. And which basically means less time, exposure time for our crews out in the field, up on the poles, or in the trailers doing the splicing. We're looking at tools. There's a technology out there that does an optical assessment of your pole contact, so you can do your measurements back in the office instead of in the field through optical couplings. And wearable technologies, we're just starting to look at that. Man down or body temperature. So if you're working in a very hot temperature environment, you can get alerts that you are maybe approaching a danger zone. So these are technologies that are non-traditional networking, but they're in the outside plant. So we look at those as well.
Bob, you had mentioned something and I just zipped by me. What did you say about the technology and the 10 gigabits per second?
So bandwidth is what we manage all the time. Mm-hmm. And so the bandwidth need at the customer's end is increasing. So these platforms have a definite limitation of what they can provide in that bandwidth capability. This latest platform has some advanced features where you can replace just a subcomponent of the system to acquire some very high bandwidth capacities to meet the most demanding customers on the edge.
Okay, so most demanding customer.
Yes, it would not be the typical. It'd be the very demanding. That's a lot.
Whoa. That's mind-boggling.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
But it's nice to know that we have the platform and the technology that's already can adapt for that bandwidth need going mm-hmm. forward.
I have to say, I just visited a fairly large urban city where it just over and over and over, the conversation I was hearing from people is their struggle and their frustration with their internet providers being mainly large, you know, the Comcast, the big providers, mm-hmm. and the really lousy service they were getting and the high cost that they were paying for. And I just compared to what we have, that was a real learning opportunity for me. And so, anyway.
Well, our key asset being the fiber optics all the way to the home is one that puts us above anybody and everybody else because the bandwidth across fiber is essentially unlimited. So we just have to change out incrementally the equipment that runs the light through the optics or through the fiber.
So anyway, you caught my attention when you said.
Good.
So I'm going to come back to that on the next slide. If you'll remember, the results of the wireless proof of concept led us to determine that it was not disruptive and it was not something that we could use immediately in the network. However, on the bandwidth example, and to your point, Commissioner McKenna, what we did is we implemented a change in the network that gave us cost-effective bandwidth solutions. It was technology that was part of the existing vendor profile. What we did was invest in the capability to add technology or add bandwidth in incremental portions so that lowers our future cost. It lowers our immediate cost, but it also allows us to add the bandwidth when we need it at a lower marginal cost. Hmm. And rather than give the bandwidth to everybody, we have the capability to put the bandwidth where we need it. So again, we're focused on the overall cost equation within the network. Bob also mentioned the outside plant, and I apologize. There was a word that's left off this last bullet point. It should say new opportunities to improve efficiency through technology. So even though we have something as simple as a splice case, which is a passive device, by looking at new technology, it allows us to improve the efficiency of the workforce and ultimately lower our O&M cost. But that's, again, a case of being out there, looking at it, determining where it fits into our network. How do we fit it in? How do we integrate it? Which takes me to the conclusion.
Mike, may I go back? To the middle bullet point of
yes.
the last slide. When you're talking about the bandwidth demand, and again, correct my perception, so we can do this without pitting one demand against another. We could serve both, as the demands come in. Would that be a competitive situation? Who got there first, or... can we serve both masters? How does that work?
We have to serve both masters.
Okay.
And when we talk bandwidth, we have to look at it from multiple perspectives. The lowest level perspective is at the user level.
Mm-hmm.
If we have a number of high bandwidth users that are all assigned to the same optical line terminal card, that line terminal card can get overloaded.
Okay.
So with this upgrade that we did, we have the ability to go in and put a new generation OLT, which will go from 2.4 gigabits per second shared to 10 gigabits per second shared. Or we can reallocate the users amongst the existing OLTs to spread that high demand out amongst multiple cards. On the backside of that OLT, you're linking into the core of the network, and we have multiple tools there and the ability to add higher speed links to add capacity, bandwidth capacity, within the core of the network.
Okay.
And it is a balancing situation to keep all of those in balance, which also entails monitoring and measuring and managing that bandwidth at ever different element of the network.
Yeah. So, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a long-range technology plan has captured a guiding philosophy. It's captured a network management philosophy and all the tools that we need. And what it really does is allow us an assessment of what ifs before they become must-dos. That's the future-looking part of it. And it also ultimately provides us that basis for achieving best asset value, to only spend what we need to manage the demand that we have in the near-term future. So, questions?
Commissioners?
That's great.
Good
report.
Good update.
Question I had earlier, and I'm trying to get to it, talking about that it's a repository. Mm-hmm. So is it a ongoing repository? because it's such a rapidly changing mm-hmm. arena, new in, old out,
mm-hmm.
or?
It is a collection of documents, both electronic and other media. Ultimately, what comes out of that is a strategy document that we use to make those decisions. And as with any strategy document, you're trying to pick a point in the future with what you know today to say, as our bandwidth needs change, this is our next step in growing the network, in changing the network. Obviously, things change, and they change rapidly. So, yes, it's a case where information that we got 6 months ago may no longer be valid. The vendor may have changed the roadmap that they provided us, or they may end up dropping a series of products, and we have to then say, what do we do? Where do we go from here? How do we react to this change? And it involves ultimately rewriting a strategy and pinpointing what our decision points are.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you.
I'm trying to keep that in layman's terms to describe what
it worked, at least for this layman.
Okay.
Appreciate that. So. And I'd like to say, to you, and to the communication staff and all that work on it, our presentations are excellent. It was a meeting last week where consistently the presenter was apologizing. I know you can't see these numbers from there. Guys, you guys, thanks to all of you for keeping it clean and simple, and we can see everything from where we are. So appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Astonwater.
Yep, I want to invite Dave Lodge, Ron Slaybaugh to come up. We're going to talk a little bit about this. Remember, this project was in doubt for a while because we were waiting for the state capital budget to get approved, but that has happened, and so now we're getting ready to go here.
Good morning.
David Lodge, project manager with engineering and project management. I'm here with
Ron Soyabaugh, water wastewater manager.
And we're here to give you an update on the Shaston Wastewater Treatment Facility Improvement Project. It's been about a year since we presented on this project, just as we were getting design underway. And so we wanted to give you just an update on the overall project status, tell you what's going on with the funding from Ecology, and then also take you through the process to adopt our project budget and next steps to get things going. This presentation is informational only, but we will be coming back in 2 weeks requesting a budget revision through board motion.
Project status. Been here a number of times over the last, 6 or 7 years talking about this TMDL. That acronym stands for Total Maximum Daily Load. Let's step back a moment to Clean Water Act 1972, from that Department of Ecology's required to establish water quality standards to protect the designated uses for waters of the state, and to monitor those waters to ensure that they meet compliance with those water quality standards. So Ecology did that for many waters in the state, including the Wenatchee River, and found that it was out of compliance with pH and dissolved oxygen. So that put the Wenatchee River on what's called the 303D list, which required that this TMDL be developed to find out why it doesn't meet water quality standards and what it'll take for it to meet water quality standards. It was a collection of studies that we refer to as the TMDL that were completed, and Ecology adopted that document, or finalized that document, in 2009. Essentially, phosphorus was determined to be the cause of the pH and dissolved oxygen exceedances. The phosphorus causes algae to grow on the rocks, and the diurnal respiration of the algae causes the pH and dissolved oxygen to go up and down. pH was the big issue in the Wenatchee River. And the phosphorus, one of the large sources of the phosphorus is the wastewater treatment discharges at Leavenworth, Peshaston, Dryden, and Cashmere. So as part of the TMDL document, Ecology developed phosphorus allocations and reductions that needed to be achieved. And for the treatment plants, that's roughly 99% removal of phosphorus. So we began planning what it would take for us to actually meet those reductions at Peshaston. I believe the first public meeting that we had was in 2012 for actually Peshaston and Dryden, and we had a meeting at the Shaston School and just had a whole host of options that were evaluated. And we had proposed at that time a combined Peshaston-Dryden project. You might recall that we were looking at pumping Dryden up to Peshaston and just upgrading the Peshaston treatment plant. So we moved along that line and started some pre-design in 2015 and into 2016. But what we found as we completed pre-design is that the cost of that pipeline was a heck of a lot higher than what we had anticipated in earlier years for a number of reasons. We had also applied for some funding from Ecology in 2015, and there was no funding available in 2016. So we talked with Ecology some about our two projects and about the lack of grant funding, and agreed that we would separate those projects out. We would focus on Peshaston treatment now and deal with Dryden as a separate project. One fortunate thing with Dryden is it does not have a pipe discharge directly to the river like the other treatment plants do, and that gives Ecology some flexibility in the compliance schedule for Dryden. So it made sense to separate it from Peshaston. We're working with Ecology on Dryden separately. So move back to Peshaston. We put together a pre-design report for the Peshaston treatment plant upgrade, and that was completed in February 2017. We identified that cost at $3.5 million. We continued with final design, and we finished that up just earlier this month. And for a number of reasons, which David will discuss later, the final costs have increased to about $4.1 million. I would like to talk, just before I get into the project benefits here, just a little bit about that design process. We engaged a consultant. We don't have that expertise in-house to design a treatment plant. We engaged a consultant that does have that expertise. But we were highly engaged in that process. We had at least a half a dozen check-in meetings with the consultant and reviews. And there was at least two of those where I remember just stepping back and asking the question, is what we're doing here, upgrading this treatment plant, is this the best and the least cost long-term alternative? I just want to make sure that we weren't in tunnel vision of here's our treatment plant. We have to upgrade this plant. So we talked about a number of different alternatives, building a new plant in entirety or changing the technology within this plant, going from the current biological process, what we refer to as sequencing batch reactors, and going to a flow-through process, or going from sand filters to membranes. We talked about a lot of different things, and we kept on coming back to this does represent the least project cost for meeting the goals that we need to meet with this particular facility.
So and this made for some very long meetings, but it was very good discussion.
One thing some of you might not know about David in his past, I won't call it past life, but past career, he worked for a general contractor that specialized in treatment plant constructions and upgrades. So he was really valuable in these meetings with the engineering consultant. We performed a lot of value engineering looking at constructability, for example. Because sometimes we can design things that when we go to construct them, perhaps they fall a little bit short on the constructability side and end up costing a lot more money. And I feel that in this particular case, with the design engineer we had, plus David's past experience as a contractor, we have something that certainly is constructible and, again, will meet our needs quite well in Shaston. Project benefits, of course, regulatory compliance. You know, the current date that Ecology has identified for us to be discharging and meeting this 99% phosphorus removal is March 1st of 2020. Another benefit of this upgrade, this plant has been operational since 1997, so it's over 20 years old now. Much of the mechanical and electrical equipment has reached end of life. In the last year and a half, there's been two instances where we had some failures that resulted in us having to staff that plant around the clock while we got those fixed. One of them was a programmable logic controller, PLC failure, that we had to get changed out. And our tech shop here only has one laptop that still has the early version of XP installed that can use the software to load back onto that PLC. So we're having all of that replaced as part of this project as well, along with some other mechanical equipment that, as I mentioned, it has 20-year design life, and we're at 21 years now. That'll improve the reliability of the facility, provide some operational flexibility. We have to take this phosphorus that's in liquid form and concentrate it and keep it out of the effluent that's discharged to the river. And we're providing a number of different ways that the operator can achieve that. So we'll have some flexibility to find out specifically what works best once the plant is operational. We're also going to improve safety. That control system that I mentioned is a terrible, it creates an arc flash hazard, where we have 480-volt power along with the control systems and the PLC all inside the same cabinet. So the tech shop has to take on additional safety measures, appropriate clothing and such, whenever they open up that cabinet to work on the controls.
So as Ron mentioned, we completed our cost estimate with the final design, and the total project cost estimate is at $4.1 million. This is an increase from the anticipated cost estimate of $3.5 million at pre-design. That includes some contingency for the construction and then also the district labor and the engineering during construction as well. So some of the cost factors that occurred over the last year, first I want to start with our value engineering process. So throughout the course of design, we kept looking at the scope saying, is this absolutely essential for meeting the compliance requirement with this project? And there was quite a few opportunities we took to reduce scope or reuse equipment within the design or make changes to try to reduce the impact of the overall project cost. But there were a few factors that did increase the cost, and I want to touch on those briefly. In the new design, there's some large effluent filters that we originally planned to locate outdoors. During the design process, we interviewed some other owners who used the same equipment and had done the same thing, installed them outdoors, and said it's very difficult to manage them operationally. Ron can speak better to this, but can you talk about the sand?
Oh, sure. So the two facilities that we visited were Plummer, Idaho, and Moscow, Idaho. Plummer actually started with their filters outside and ended up coming back later and constructing a building over the top of them. In our case, we'll be able to take the filters out of service for several months over the winter, but we do have to put them back in service in February and to be operational by March. What the other facilities found is when the filters are removed from service, and particularly as that sand gets cold and it freezes, it just turns into a ball. And even after it thaws back out again, it's still a ball, somewhat like concrete. They have to go in with these, they call it air lancing, very large air compressor and these pipes, and go in and jam it down into that sand to get it fluidized again so they can actually start filtering with it. And that was one of the big problems. Moscow, Idaho actually had their filters below ground, but because of the sand turning into this ball, they would still heat their filters. They would hang heaters down inside of them to prevent the problems of trying to get them started up again. So they strongly recommended that we put them inside based on their experiences.
So we couldn't ignore that information. We moved the filters into the new process building, which increased the square footage and also the height of the building. So the building got larger, and therefore costs associated with the new process building increased. Additionally, some of the equipment that we had gotten preliminary pricing last year has increased over the course of the year. And so there's not much we can do except take what we know now and incorporate that into our estimate. And all of these things are still just an estimate. Our engineer has a lot of experience, and they have some very recent bids that they can look at. But we have not bid out the project yet. And this is a very tough bid environment. Contractors are very busy, and this is a unique project because it's not very large, but it's very complex. Additionally, we have federal requirements associated with the grant funding, so it's going to take the right contractor, and we're doing everything we can to do contractor outreach locally and outside of the region, try to get interest in the project and create competition with the general contractor as well as the equipment bidders.
Okay, the dollars. Steve introduced us. He mentioned that the state approved their budget this year, and that included grant funding for our project and others within the state. So currently for this Peshastin project, we have just under $2.2 million in grant funding, and that includes $168,000 in what's referred to as a forgivable principal loan. The remainder of the project, Ecology, will fund in a low-interest loan. We're still revising our funding agreement with Ecology to include that grant. That's that $2,007,000 grant that was approved by the legislature. So we're fine-tuning that interest rate right now, but we're certain it'll be something less than 2%. I want to back up a little bit to 2015 when the board approved the 2015 through 2019 strategic plan, and we followed up. I think we were here the next week to propose financial policies for water and wastewater. Then we followed up with rate action for water and wastewater shortly after that. With that strategic planning, we had the combined Peshastin-Dryden project, and it was forecasted at about $5.3 million at that time. But with Peshastin coming in at $4.1 million, we're still not sure what we're going to do at Dryden. But we have forecasted just a $2 million placeholder for Dryden. That puts us at $6.1 million total, which is higher than the 5.3 that was identified in 2015. With the grant funding that we know that we have, plus additional grant funding, crossing our fingers, we would hope to acquire for Dryden, we have about a $475,000 shortfall compared to what was forecasted back in 2015 and what was covered by the 5% five-year rate action for the wastewater utility. So we've completed, as of April, four of those five rate actions for wastewater. The fifth, of course, will be in April of 2019. So we don't have to make any action on this today. I just wanted you to be aware that compared to 2015, there are some changes financially with the wastewater system. So it's something that we're going to want to think about in the next strategic plan and think about in any rate action for wastewater in 2020 and beyond.
What is the current monthly residential rate at Peshastin?
$72-$73, I believe, for residential.
Still well behind Cashmere then. $99.50 at Cashmere.
Yeah, and I understand Cashmere just broke 100.
I haven't seen my latest bill.
So the next step is to approve our project budget. Currently, we're just budgeted for the annual spending forecast, but we need to adopt the budget for the entire project. And this would be done with a board motion, and we need to do that prior to soliciting the construction bid. So to tie all this together, right now we're working with Ecology to provide a project approval, and they're looking at the cost estimate as well as the design, and we anticipate that approval this week. Then we would come back at the next board meeting to present the budget revision or motion approval, and we're going to go out to bid on thickener equipment. We have one unique piece of equipment that we're going to procure separate from the construction contract, and then we'll put the construction bid out on the street. We plan to open those bids late June, possibly into July, and our goal is to issue notice to proceed by August. Then the anticipated duration is 18 months, and our compliance deadline is March 1st of 2020. So we don't have a ton of float on the schedule, and we really need to take advantage of this construction season to do all the groundwork before winter. So that's our plan to get the project going.
Ron, could you help me with the thickener? That's a process, not a person's name.
Correct.
The equipment.
Yeah. So I mentioned before that for these plants to be successful to remove 99% of this phosphorus, we have to concentrate a stream of phosphorus and keep it out of the final effluent. This piece of thickener equipment is one of the specialized pieces of equipment that we'll use to achieve that.
So the phosphorus then ends up condensing down into a thick liquid?
Yeah, it's a thick liquid that we then put into the digesters, and we can store, we can dewater it, remove it off-site, haul it off-site as liquid. That's some of the operational flexibility that I mentioned earlier as well.
So where does it go?
The thickener?
Yeah, once it's thickened.
Oh, the solids. Yeah.
Consolidated
phosphorus.
Yeah. Where does the phosphorus go?
It's consolidated with the solids, and then it's land applied up in Mansfield.
Oh, okay.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Ron can talk for a really long time about this. It's very interesting. So that's him after the meeting.
Yeah, I'll try not to stimulate.
Maybe after lunch.
Yeah.
So next steps, we plan to return and present the budget revision and then advertise our construction bid. Glad Eric got that.
I did get that, yeah. So you'll seek bid approval at the same time you do the motion in May, the budget revision?
Advertise.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. It's under $3
million. Oh, okay. No need then.
Yeah.
David, I just need to apologize. I just referred to you as Ron, and that could be a compliment or not, but I just wanted to clarify that my mistake. That's humor.
When we're finished with this part, we might want to just take a minute and go back and tie this in with the regionalization study while you're right here, Dave. And I've got a report that I want to talk, and I thought maybe we would, well.
Okay.
Right, I'm throwing you a curve here. So I want to make sure this is done, and then I'd like to take a minute and talk about the regionalization study.
Okay. Sure. Are there any other questions on?
Just one. The Department of Ecology's leniency on the Dryden plant. Any sense of how much time they're going to give us?
They initially indicated that we could have up to two permit cycles, which would be another 10 years to be fully constructed. But that was verbally. And we're negotiating the revised permit for Dryden that will actually include compliance schedule and those milestones. So I anticipate within this next permit cycle, within the next 5 years, perhaps a little bit less, they're going to want to see a revision to our engineering report with whatever option, whatever it is we want to do at Dryden, along with the cost and such, submitted to them for approval. Then the next step, of course, would be design and then funding and construction. Mm-hmm. Okay. Which I'm optimistic that can roll over into the next permit cycle.
Good.
How many customers on the Peshastin system?
We have 170 connections, I believe. Of course, the two large ones, Hyatt and Bluebird.
Any other questions? All right.
Can
item two,
so before we let Ron slip away, I wanted to just report as a commissioner who sat on the regionalization study committee. As you can see, we've got this one small project, but we've got issues up and down the river where small communities have been struggling with cost and requirements from ecology, et cetera. And so for last year, we've studied this, and Ron's been a big part of that. And we received his report recently that the committee has completed their study and made some recommendations. And so we've looked at the data, and it doesn't appear that consolidation regionally with the oversight of the PUD is cost effective at this time. But from my standpoint, it still doesn't change the fact that as these requirements up and down the river still need to be met, and individual communities are going to be struggling with this, I think it still periodically is going to be brought up in the next 10 years or so to continue to be looking at this. But I just did, it was a fascinating study for a year to get the data and to really look at it and say, at this point, and all parties agreed that it's not effective at this time. And I think I came away with, and I want to get Ron's reaction to this too, that it still isn't going to preclude smaller systems like the Peshastin Water system come back at us and say individually they're going to need some assistance and support and for us to be prepared for those requests. But I was pleased that particularly with the workload of the PUD at this point, we can take that off our list and say we're not adding to that, we're not moving forward, there's going to be no recommendations for the PUD to look at oversight or regionalization of sewer and water, but I think it's still out on the horizon that we may see some individual requests come at us down the road. So I don't know, Ron, is it, if there's you want to react to that, or I'm catching off guard here, but I did want to make that report and have you here as a resource in case there were any further questions from commissioners.
Sure. Yeah, and Steve Keene, commissioner from Peshastin Water District, approached me briefly after that last regionalization meeting was over on Thursday and just expressed their interest in having the PUD look at acquiring their system. I think they've submitted two written requests to us so far, and you might recall they ran into some issues with some coliform in a well last October or November that they had to deal with and some costs, and they just don't have the staff resources to handle that sort of thing. You know, that system was built new. Well, shoot, I want to say it was 14, 15 years ago. They put an entire new distribution system. Reservoirs are fairly new. And with everything being brand new, I won't say it ran itself. It was very reliable for quite some time, but it's aging and they're starting to run into some issues with it. They're just starting to question their capability to provide reliable service without the resources. So you're correct. That's something that folks can continue to ask us, and we have a process to evaluate those requests. So no doubt that'll come up. My comment on any questions on that? I want to transition.
I'm just at some point. Be interesting to hear exactly what the process is that you take when people bring that to you.
Oh, sure. Think about some of these LUDs, even Lake Wenatchee Wastewater, Peshastin Wastewater, Alala Canyon, Sleepy Hollow Water. It starts with a request, a petition from the customers for us to evaluate the feasibility. And then the board can direct staff either to do that or not to do that. Then we evaluate the feasibility and go back to the public with what that looks like, what the cost would be. And then the public decides whether or not you have to have a majority approval. With the majority of the approval, actually the public doesn't decide, but if we get majority approval from the public, then the board can direct staff to go on to the next step of forming that local utility district, design, construction, everything that goes along with it.
Have we denied any of those?
What's that?
Have we denied any of those?
Do I get a vote?
A vote?
No, we haven't. We haven't. And I think, I actually think, Commissioner, there are a number of available processes for us to evaluate taking on, particularly taking on an existing system, right? Not unlike what we did in Kashmir when we took on the electric system and began to make those infrastructure upgrades. It wouldn't necessarily require an LUD to purchase or to take on an existing system. It might, though, if there are a particular number of upgrades that are required in order to take a system that one might consider failing and move it over. So I think there are a number of options.
The study that we did with the regionalization study really looked at each community up and down the river at the cost of what was the term, the blend shearing or
the rate blending.
The rate blending.
Sure.
What that would do up and down the river. It looked at the governance structure of either forming a new, completely separate utility to oversee and govern, or to have the PUD oversee it with some advisory committees. And it was a very lengthy process, very detailed. Consultant was brought in to assist with that, and in the end, the groups decided that it just wasn't appropriate, feasible at this time. But, so anyway, that's the end of my report on that.
One more comment. Do we have? I think we did a lessons learned on the monitor LUD process. We did not do a lessons learned. I was interested in that. If we did.
Yeah, I don't recall that we did either.
Maybe we can revisit that and have somebody come up with off the top of their head lessons learned, because I'm sure we did learn some.
Well, there's only senior staff and commissioners have turned over since that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just looking over at Jeff Smith. He's getting out of here just in time. We're going to go back.
Maybe,
and
maybe
that.
We can make that a final assignment.
Out of here.
I'm looking at Ron Slabaugh.
Yeah.
I actually.
Can you do that now, Jeff? Okay.
I actually think the core team that worked on that system is still here, that LUD. I know it was Jeff and Ron and I and a number of other people that took that on.
Still have the scars.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I guess, we all need to be mindful and help all the communities understand that there comes a time in structure, whether it's electrical, water, or wastewater, where the size of the community does not allow them to go forward with their own financing and rate structure. Kashmir ended up in a situation with its electrical system where it was not feasible for that size of community to do that on their own. And I think looking at water and wastewater issues, there also needs to be a reminder and an education that goes along with that it's not necessarily our goal to create equity, but to realize that there is a thought or a process that's involved, that a utility doesn't drive people putting for sale signs in their front yards because they can no longer afford to live there. And so then, what is the obligation of this institution to be involved with those communities and literally what they can afford or not? And so this is just a philosophical statement, but I think we need to be mindful, of that as we go through these processes. So
now that we've totally destroyed Steve's planned agenda, because I see people in the room, I have one more thing for Ron that I
you can tell I'm getting antsy over.
Come on, you guys.
Just for the fellow commissioners' knowledge, the latest group of Kyrgyz are in town from the sister region relationship with Chelan County, and there's eight delegates in this group, and one of their specific requests in coming here, interestingly, was to be able to take a look at existing water and wastewater treatment facilities. And, you know, we don't think about that as being a high-profile item in our country, but there's a lot of varying circumstances around the world. So anyway, I put together a tour with the Kyrgyz visitors of the Kashmir facility, which is a new $25 million facility, and asked Ron if he would be willing to join the group to share maybe comments and observations from a smaller facility. And Ron's going to do that on Wednesday afternoon, and I just want to give a shout out and say thank you, because there's two very different sets of experiences and thoughts that go into those two facilities, and it'll be good for their knowledge and building our sister region relationship. So thank you, Ron.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I really look forward to it.
Yeah.
And Ron, I was giving you a bad time earlier, but we do appreciate your passion for what you do and how you do it very much. So
thank you, Dennis.
Thank you. All right.
If you wouldn't mind, I'd like to move a manager item up if we could. We've had Bill Christman here to talk about the some issues going on in the Chelan Gorge, and I'd like to get him up here and get a chance to inform you as to what the current status is.
So good morning again, commissioners. While Bill is getting the board set up, Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services. Bill is the Chief Engineer for Dam Safety and Natural Resources. And we're here to discuss an active landslide risk above the Chelan River Gorge. Bill has recently identified what is a natural condition and not caused by our hydro operations. Nonetheless, he does feel the risk of failure is imminent, and it's likely to create a temporary earthen dam in the gorge when that does happen. And as soon as he's ready.
So, Chelan Gorge. Let's
get that. How about if you just have a seat and sit in front of the microphone? That'd be great.
Chelan Gorge is an active geologic feature. It's relatively young from a geologic standpoint, and it's still undergoing erosion changes that are not affected or caused by hydro operations, but that have the potential to affect hydro operations. So today I'm simply giving you an update on something that we've been watching for some decades, but that recently started to show us more movement than we've seen before, and in a larger area than we've seen before. I got to stress that it's a natural phenomena that we don't affect, but has the potential to affect us. So about 3 miles downstream of the dam, there's a real steep section of the gorge, and that steepness has a effect on earth stability, and there's been instability in there for as long as we've had a hydro operation, and long before that. So one last time, it's a natural phenomena, and in this particular case, we've been observing that area and have seen surficial ground movement that's pretty consistent. There used to be some land farming, final wastewater polishing operations that occurred there, and once we saw that land movement, we worked with that stakeholder, and they readily discontinued that operation and moved it somewhere else. So that hasn't been there for a long time. But if there's an earth movement into the gorge, somebody might recollect that, and I simply wanted to point out that that hasn't existed for a long time and isn't really a risk. But this smallish area that we observe for a long time continues to move. It's got a depth of maybe 10 or 20 or 30 feet, depending on where in that area we refer to. So it's not by any means a deep-seated rotational failure like the OSO event experienced. It's a superficial, relatively shallow ground mobilization that is natural, and we're now observing it out in that area. And that's a pretty fresh feature. It's likely, we think, that material will come off of this area like that relatively smallish fresh feature. It's possible that an entire 1,200 foot length or so could come off at one time, given a really severe rainstorm or a seismic event. And if that happens, then there's a potential that there be a temporary earth dam in the gorge, and we'd need to evaluate whether to shut off spill for a short period of time, increase spill. It really depends on the character of the failure, if it ever occurs in a big way. In the mid-1990s, we had a slope failure near the Chelan Reach 2 area, so the maybe mile and a half or so below the dam, and it washed almost forgot I had that. And it washed all the way down into what we call Reach 4. There's Powerhouse, County Road, treatment plant like Ron was just talking about. And this area used to be relatively free of gravels and sands. And it filled up with that event. That event was about 100,000 yards of material. And the event that we're potentially looking at in somewhat of a worst case is about 100,000 yards of material. We ended up being able to wash most of that material into the Columbia River, which simulates a natural event, and the rest of it we turned into valuable Reach 4 habitat. If the event comes off in a relatively bigger, broader fashion, then it probably will interfere with our habitat, and at that time we'll need to simply decide with our stakeholders what to do next. So simply bringing you one of the significant next steps for us is to put together a incident-specific emergency action plan. So something happens that's large, we'll have worked with internal and external stakeholders prior to that point to evaluate how to deal with it, so we hit the ground running instead of flailing our arms.
So in response to Bill's conclusions recently, we did develop an internal team, starting with the emergency action plan that Bill's going to take the lead on. We're also getting an outside consultant to help us take an evaluation of that area. We're installing hazard warning signs. We're informing the public starting today. We've also notified a number of other entities, agencies included, in the last week. Bill mentioned the Reach 4 habitat area. There'll be a plan developed for that. We're also considering indefinitely canceling the annual whitewater boating event in the gorge because of the concern of the hazards and the rockfall that will persist even if there's not a landslide. Something we're talking to FERC about right now since it's a license requirement. Back to you. Do you have something else you want to add?
Just one more graphic that helps show what the surface expressions of this ground mobilization look like. The area that has moved for 20 or 25 years or so that we've observed is right here. Yep. And the area where we're starting to see some signs of surface activity that looks similar to what we've observed before is in this area.
movement that direction and places where at the very edge it falls into the river. Hopefully it'll always act just like that. Might come off in a bigger way, but it is surficial as opposed to an oso like circular event.
So, Bill, when you had the event in the 90s, how did you clean that out? Just by a lot of spill and flushing it out?
Yeah, that was, that's a good question. And yes, the simple answer is yes, it occurred during a high discharge event. And so we maintain that high discharge event to move it on down. This could happen when there's only 80 CFS. The normal low flow that we have as a licensed condition. And so as part of the temporary emergency action plan or the incident specific emergency action plan, we try to work with our stakeholders through various scenarios and how to respond to those.
How would you ever get big, heavy equipment in there if you did have a really large event and had to clean it out?
I'm glad you asked me that. I was going to mention it, I forgot to. We're really confident that the best way to deal with it is to not put any people or equipment in there, but to use releases from the hydropower project, from the dam, to manage the evacuation of material from the steep part of the gorge. So we don't have anybody in there.
But what if you have a solid earthen dam form?
Yeah, great question. We'll look at that. There's enough material in there to make a 20, 30 foot tall, relatively long earth condition. Mm-hmm. It's a steep enough area that doesn't take water all that far upstream. So gaining the top elevation of whatever earth feature and causing some erosion that works its way back down into that area is probably how that would become mobilized all the way through the rest of the system. Hmm. Non-sudden failure, something that's carefully managed. Big deal. Hmm. Probably kind of messy down in Reach 4. Probably has some impacts for the County Road Bridge near Chelan Falls, but I think all of those are conditions that can be responsibly and effectively and quickly dealt with. We just want to put together a plan before we get there to make sure that we hit the ground running and don't have a time loss due to a significant period of surprise and wondering what to do next.
Certainly one other thing we also...
I'm sorry,
go ahead.
Could probably certainly affect our fish rearing area in the gravel area down below. It would have a little larger one.
Pardon me?
We'd have certainly a little larger area for the...
Yeah, there's a positive...
For the reds.
...outlook.
Yeah.
One other thing that we've done is, as you know, we're working with the Lake Chelan Trails Alliance and the city to develop that new extension to Reach One Trail. And we have taken off the southernmost portion of that because of this concern. And the Alliance and the city are very comfortable with that, just as a safety precaution.
Yeah. That we have to be responsible because it could create a Darwin effect.
So I'd just like to summarize a couple of key points. This is really a serious situation, but I also don't want people to overreact to it. So as long as people don't go in there, there's no risk to public health and safety here, no risk to humans. If a failure does occur, an earthen dam could be formed. And even that, if it were formed, is not necessarily a problem unless there were a sudden failure of the earthen dam. And that, then you've got a big wall of water coming down. That would be a problem. So you do want to address that. And most likely the best way to address that would be through some sort of controlled releases from the Chelan Dam, which could impact reservoir levels at that point. But there's a lot between here and there. And I want to make sure that we recognize that we're just getting prepared here in case there were a problem.
You said that really well. Can I add one thing? Mm-hmm. And that we expect that it will likely come off little by little by little over a long time and basically be a non-event.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
Mr. Wright, are there any other manager items that will fit into a four-minute slot?
I would like to get one more in here if we could. I want to invite Rich Hyatt to come up. So a question had come up last time about how we protect our people from minors who may be acting in an unauthorized way and may not want us to know about that. And so we have engaged Rich to talk about that.
Well, good afternoon, Commissioners. Rich Hyatt, Director of Security. Wanted to give a quick update on some of our activities associated with Bitcoin issues as of late. We're working with Kerry and Sarah Delosha's teams. We've been brought into the loop about a week and a half ago. We've been coming up with an investigation flow chart, a notification tree. We've dealt with already the county attorney who's agreed to handle or prosecute cases that are of repeat offender nature. The reason being, first-time offenders, it won't show that intent. That's why we're going to be getting involved with being able to serve cease and desist letters, getting those cases developed. We've also spoken with Steve Crown, Chief of Police for Wenatchee, as well as Sheriff Brian Burnett, Chelan County Sheriff's Office, and have an agreement with those agencies that we could use their agencies as the mechanism that when we prepare a case and gather the evidence and establish probable cause, that we could actually take that case through their detectives, and they'll be able to help refer them to the county attorney for prosecution consideration. So some of the things that we're doing internally, we've just done a lot of physical security measures recently in our lobby at HQ. We've put in some ballistic panels. We've increased the camera coverage at the service building. We've also designed and going into construction phase for a very small storefront lobby, which at the service building, that would give the employees a lot more security without having personnel or customers be able to walk right into their work area. And we're monitoring those areas pretty much. We've trained our security officers to look for negative body language, people who are being agitated. We're doing a lot of walkthroughs when we do see that. We've instructed frontline staff on the use of panic buttons. We're also going to be advising field personnel as we start rolling and getting involved with these Bitcoin investigations. We'll be able to put out security bulletins on tactics and techniques as a situational awareness piece, so our field folks could kind of see what some of the red flags are associated with that activity. So with that, it's going to be leveraging internal staff to help with investigations. It's funny, about 2.5 years ago when I started here, I asked Kerry Wendell if the district has any energy theft, because I did a lot of that in my former place of employment, and she said, no, they don't. Now here we are 2.5 years later going down that road. So it's new. It's definitely an opportunity for us to protect assets. It's an opportunity for us to protect our field personnel, extend some workplace violence prevention program into the field for those personnel that are on the front lines.
I mentioned the two outlying offices.
Oh, yeah. Next week sometime, we're going up. We're doing a security assessment of Leavenworth and Lake Chelan. Going to be going up there training those folks up there on workplace violence issues. We're going to be making some security recommendations that how we can enhance their safety and security. And I've been dealing with John Stoll on that issue as well.
Okay. Comments, questions? Jeff, Rich, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the attention to it.
Now we're good for lunch.
We're good for lunch. Be back at 1 o'clock. Recess until then.
Thanks. We got through it. I was hoping we'd get through. So we should be able to be pretty quick in the afternoon. And, shoot for like a 1:30.
Your body language move forward.
Yep.
Like, oh, okay. I think I'm reading that right. Let's open this afternoon's session of Chelan County PUD Board of Directors. And again, the date is April 30th. And I believe at this point, if there's nothing to left on the morning agenda, we're at the point of taking a look at our consent agenda. Is that correct? Okay.
To approve the consent agenda, which would include item number 9, we move from the regular agenda to the consent agenda.
Okay. Second that.
Okay. Is there any other discussion regarding the consent agenda? Since there's actually a resolution being moved forward to it, all those in favor of accepting consent agenda as presented with the resolution 9 being included, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no.
Aye.
Motion is carried. Thank you, Gary. Manager items, we continue there.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit, ask Tyler Sellers if he'd come up, Jeff Smith, talk about the, we did a big concrete pour last week.
Oh,
and yeah. I'll tell you a little bit about that.
Hear that. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services, and Tyler Sellers is joining us, Construction Manager Extraordinaire. This young man is doing just wonderful work for the district. Glad to have him here. As Steve indicated, last Thursday was a significant milestone in implementation of the long-range facilities plan. It involved pouring the concrete floor for the new 20,000-square-foot storage facility at Rock Island. That's the first building that's contained within the plan to be acted on. But it wasn't a normal concrete pour. It was a continuous 12-hour effort that involved 720 cubic yards of concrete and 73 truckloads. And Tyler's going to fill in the rest of the story.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Tyler Sellers, if we haven't met. We went into our facilities building, and we were looking at the slab that goes into it. It's a 250 foot by 80 foot building. It is designed to have a concrete slab that's more structurally sound than an airport runway due to the loads that we're planning to see on it with our big turbine components and crane work. Through some value engineering that Homey Builders, our contractor who's working on the project, they brought to us, we were able to take that component of the building and reduce it from a multiple slab pour with a great deal more foundation work that would be required for it, and reduce it down to one single slab. One pour, one and done, and the district was able to receive a $65,000 deduct in the cost of the work to boot. So in moving forward with it, a lot of effort went into it. It took about 2 to 2.5 weeks of effort through all of the different parties involved to get this piece of work done. Just to give you an idea on the site here, if you can see my cursor, the guard post on the Chelan County side, guard post 6, is down here, and the river is up here in the top right corner, and the dam due north of this area. This section here is where the storage building is located, and it's, as Jeff said, the first major building that's going in of many to come, and so it's kind of a big flagship piece of the work. The next part of it, some additional details that we have, 20,000 square foot slab, so it's about the size of a football field. There were 9.7 miles of 1-inch size rebar in it, which not much in town gets rebar of that size or that much. So that was kind of fun to see. We rounded down 700 cubic yards. In talking with our concrete suppliers here in town, that was one of the largest pours in the valley's history. So kind of momentous for them as well. 72 concrete truckloads. This was an interesting thing that I'll dive into a bit more, but we were planning, if you guys saw the newspapers and some of the radio feeds, we were planning on upwards of 112 to 115 deliveries. So we were able to reduce that, and I'll go into that in a little bit. We set up on the job with 2 concrete pumps that were supplying concrete nonstop, and we were able to reduce the pour down to only 6 hours of straight concrete placement. We were expecting almost double that. So we overproduced on this one. So, and again, one of the largest concrete pours in Wenatchee Valley history. So, couple photos from the work. We started the work. The first truck showed up at 3:45 in the morning, and we were able to complete that. Actually, last truck right at 10 o'clock a.m. We were planning for one or two, but were able to get done early. Kind of a little bird's eye view. That's where we started, and continuing on, multiple truck relocations or pump truck relocations to get reach to all the work. That's what it looked like when we started. Just a whole bunch of rebar. You probably can't even tell that it's not a floor right there. And when we're done, it's a shiny piece of strong concrete. So a lot of this work took into account a substantial amount of coordination between Chelan PUD counterparts, myself, Tim Dietering, we're the project manager and construction manager team for the project. Homie Builders played a large role. They got secondary engineering. Pacific engineers that we had under contract to do the structural engineering, they played a large part. Local concrete suppliers, Central Washington Concrete and Wenatchee Sand and Gravel, did a substantial amount of coordination with their truck drivers, Chelan County, Chelan County Police Department. And we had trucks that were brought in from outside Spokane, Moses Lake, to help with the turnaround times. And a big help that what made this pour go so well is that there's a bridge at Stamoke Creek on the Malaga Highway has a weight restriction on it. So that was only going to allow 7-yard capacity trucks to come on site, which a truck usually holds 10 yards. So that was going to prolong the duration of the work and the added trips. additionally, that was going to push the work into the afternoon. We saw some pretty good heat last Thursday up in the mid-80s. And for those that don't know, heat and concrete don't mix. You want cool, you want wet, and that helps with slab cure and crack control. So we found out I got the email at 5:32 p.m. Wednesday night, the night before I was going to get up at 2 in the morning, that Chelan County was going to raise that restriction and allow them to come with full trucks. So that's how we were able to reduce from the 115-ish down to 72 trucks. That also expedited the work, got it done faster, so that helped us with cure time and finishing on the concrete with cooler temperatures. So very good product in the end. Exciting. We were able to get it done and push through and get everybody's approval on that. And I think it opens up some doors in the future for different construction projects we have coming up that might help us get things done cheaper and faster.
So some of the advantages of the continuous pour, one day of work versus several weeks, which makes it less costly as well. No expansion joints, and therefore you don't have that checkerboard pattern of slabs. A uniform surface provides for a smoother ride. Again, this building is intended to be used for storing the generator components as we bring them to Chelan County. There's also no joint maintenance in the future. The industry has proven that it works. In fact, Kirk and I made sure the project team had some due diligence work at the end because this hadn't been done here before. We wanted to make sure it was the right technology. But Brett did some work and found the biggest continuous pours were 21,000 cubic yards. There were hotels in Abu Dhabi, Las Vegas, and Los Angeles. And we did have an experienced contractor who's done this before, and he did very well. Happy to answer any questions.
Building heated and cooled?
It is heated. I don't believe the biggest thing it is required for it is heat, mm-hmm. that components don't freeze, but there is not a cooling system on it now.
Okay.
Does have water flow for fire prevention?
It does have that. The rest of the work coming up once this slab is cured out is we're going to cast a bunch of tilt up concrete panels. That's the wall construction that goes around it.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah.
So I'm surprised you don't have any expansion joints. I mean, how do you not get cracks? Just bed it really, really well?
Combination of bedding, rebar design. There's a substantial bit of rebar in this that's more than normal. The rebar actually allows the concrete to move a bit, and it actually, the neat line quantities for this were actually about 750 yards, and we only poured 720, so it took up 30 yards of concrete that didn't have to get placed because there's so much metal in it.
Wow.
So we had, as Jeff said, a few other examples of slabs like this that had been poured. We have pictures of them. They're actually thicker than the one we did and minimal to no cracking in those slabs either. Yeah. So concrete does crack. It's part of its nature, but with the amount of steel that's in there and whatnot.
How thick is that slab?
This is a 12-inch slab.
Wow. No hand finishing, all finished with the machine?
Actually, no. I've got a bunch more pictures, but pop-off concrete out of Yakima did a great job on this slab. They actually went above and beyond with a few processes, so there is some hand finishing. As they were placing, they screeded. I wish I showed some of those. There's some floats in there that I had never even seen. 12-foot wide flat sticks, getting it within tolerances, so then they could come hit it with the power trowels. But you can kind of see in this last picture how it's a little foggy in the middle and the rest of the way down. They actually went back with a very laborious process of kind of scraping the top that pushes some of the larger aggregate down and kind of making a putty that then filled in and got a very, very flat slab. So there was a lot of handwork, and that, of course, happens when it's the hottest part in the day. It's not nice and cool when they get to do that. So,
rule of thumb has always been whenever you're pouring concrete, you never have enough people.
Ever. Right. So pop-off came with a crew of 24 guys. I had a picture. The owner was actually down on his hands and knees scrubbing out some...
The owner,
right. Yeah. And then Halmy Builders, they had 6 or 8 guys on site assisting in concrete placement. Mm-hmm. Concrete truck drivers just kind of kept coming through. So big effort.
I used to do concrete contracting, not quite that size, but I ran crews for Bethlehem and have laid a lot of large slabs, nothing that size, but proportionate enough to understand when you look at 5 riding trowels out there, plus the number of guys that are working the edges, that's sizable.
Right.
So, but anyway, that's an admirable job and much appreciated, and it's where I used to spend part of my life, and I get it. Well, so, but yeah, nice work.
Much, much more to come.
Yeah. So. That's exciting. Yeah. So, great.
All right. Thank you, Commissioners.
Glad you're there.
Thanks for the update. I want to invite Lorna up to talk about a career connection event that occurred recently.
Good afternoon. I'm once again here to, and I'm Lorna Klemanski, Managing Director of Human Resources and Safety. Once again here to talk about things that a lot of other people did, and that is the Careers After School event we had on April 17th. That was with the graphics folks here at Chelan PUD. So Thad Hunt and Tanya Doherty did a nice program that was all coordinated by Debbie Gallagher. And we had a couple of dozen students and their parents in the room, and the way Thad had organized it, they broke up into teams and did hands-on stuff themselves after he and Tanya talked a lot about what they do in graphics design. And that's a profession that is experiencing some demand. So as some jobs are changing and being replaced by automation, that's one that is pretty resilient so far. So that was a really great program. Just wanted to let you know about it.
Nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Last item is just a report on the Columbia River Treaty. There was a meeting in Spokane last week. It's the annual Lake Roosevelt Forum. The State Department invited themselves to that meeting and put together a town hall that allowed interested parties to come and speak. The power group had a minimal presence there, although there was some discussion with the State Department just to express our views. I'd say the biggest thing that's happened in the last couple of weeks is the State Department has informed the tribes that they will not get a seat at the table. They've been arguing for that for 4 years. I would say that the tribes are very surprised by that. We are not. I think it's been pretty clear all along that the governments meet with governments, and another government doesn't get a seat at the table. So they're talking about how stakeholders will be kept informed as the process moves along. And we're of course, very interested in that, too. It doesn't appear that one of the things that a previous State Department lead negotiator had suggested, which was that there would be a room for the negotiations and a room next door for stakeholders, it doesn't appear they're going to do that. So how they will keep stakeholders engaged is not clear and worrisome, candidly, to us. But how we'll be meaningfully engaged in the negotiations. So that's probably it.
That's some interesting things. Got to think of some things to think about there. So that's the end of manager items.
That's it.
Okay, commission items. Two that I'd like to bring up. One is about a month and a half ago, Steve McKenna put together a response on looking at our strategic plan and some suggestions. And one of the things that I think that would be germane is for us as a commission sometime in the near future to have, let's say, a half hour, 45-minute workshop related to the McKenna paper, and have some formulated idea of how to support the strategic plan effort going forward that meshes with administration and staff, and kind of taking a look at having all of us collectively on the same page. And so I'm proposing that in the near future that we find a time before our 10 o'clock meeting or after our afternoon meeting to have that half hour, maybe 45 minute discussion at the most in terms of that alignment. So what would be your thoughts?
Well, I personally would rather see us do it in the morning. I do better when I'm fresh.
All right.
Rather than at the end of a long meeting day.
And if we started at 9:30 with the 10 o'clock meeting coming up, that would probably guarantee we'd finish on time.
Well, yeah, we could start at 9 and give ourselves some breathing room.
Yeah, but knowing us, we will take the time that's there. So, yeah, 9 or 9:30 would be fine with me.
You know, recognizing that the Steve's going to start plotting how we establish our next strategic plan, I think us having this meeting sooner rather than later may have be the greatest value. So I'm fine. I keep telling people anytime after 6 a.m. works for me. So.
Try 4, probably 4 a.m.
Because you've already been up for a couple hours. So
yeah, he's been up since 4 a.m. doing this.
Steve?
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think this will be very helpful.
Gary?
Yes, I would concur.
So we do have a hearing on the 14th, but that's at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. If we started at 9:15.
Sounds good.
So a meeting before the meeting starting at 9:15, do we have to notice that differently?
We'll need a motion to change the start date.
Okay. So 9:15 on the 14th.
I said start date. I meant start time.
Right. For board workshop.
You want a motion?
And a singular item is the strategic plan alignment.
I would move we change the start time of our May 14th meeting to 9:15 a.m. I don't know that we can restrict it to one item once we're in session. So be
just a change in the start date.
Change in the start time.
Okay.
Second.
I was trying to curb our behavior. is there a second?
Said it.
Oh, Gary did? Thank you.
No, Ann did.
And it, all right. So you're pointing up. I thought maybe it was like to the speakers in the ceiling. Any further discussion? Okay. Those in favor of the motion as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Second item is I think all of us as commissioners received probably the same email from a patron by the name of Nick Martini wanting a meeting with each and every one of us. My thoughts are Commissioner Smith has demonstrated a willingness to meet with Mr. Martini, and I would like to authorize him to represent the board instead of having five individual meetings, have one. And I believe it's correct that you're agreeable to do that.
And I'll indicate to all of you that I indicated to Mr. Martini that I saw my role in this meeting as being a listener, and any substantive negotiation of any kind would be conducted by our senior management team.
Okay. So. I will send an email this afternoon letting him know that Commissioner Smith will be representing the commission. We'll have one meeting instead of five. All right.
Sounds good.
So those are the two items that I had for commissioner items. Any others?
Just one, as I mentioned this morning, and all are aware, there's a group, a sister region group here from the country of Kyrgyzstan. And I just wanted to issue a public thank you to Bob Bauer, who's agreed to do a tour of Rocky Reach Dam on Wednesday morning, and Commissioner Bowles is going to join us at that that event as the president of the board. So we're off and running. And also, I don't see Mike Coleman in the room, but Mike is actually home hosting the individual from the delegation who works with the electric company in Is It Cool. So Mike told me that he wasn't certain that he'd be able to explain to the guy that he doesn't really know electricity. He knows fiber, but that's but so a lot of thank yous to go around. So I'll share with you individually later how things turn out.
And that's at 9.
9 o'clock Wednesday morning at Rocky Reach.
Perfect. It'll work. Okay. Any other items?
Just to let you know, I'll be heading up to the Skaha Fish Hatchery tomorrow for events on Wednesday. Yeah. There to look at the facility up there and investments made, and looking forward to that trip.
Okay. Any other items? Lisa, Commissioner Travel?
Hello, Lisa Sanders, admin and finance, to review your upcoming travel. And I've updated my list a little bit since your version was printed, mostly on the Spokane trip for Waputa. I'm sorry, the Boise trip for NWPPA. I've updated Commissioner Arsenault's hotel, checking in the 20th and out the 24th, and reserved your airfare. Commissioner Congdon, I updated your hotel, checking in the 20th and out the 23rd.
Is the 23rd Thursday?
20,
21, 22, Wednesday. 23. Oh, I'm supposed to be checking out Thursday.
Okay.
Yeah, we'd check that.
And then for everyone else, I have the 19th to the 23rd, so I want to confirm those so I can...
What day of the week is the 19th?
19th is Saturday.
I'm going on Sunday.
Okay.
And the evening of the 23rd, that's a Wednesday, right, is the, I believe, is the big dinner. And
you're right, Ann. That starts at 9 o'clock.
Production, the... So I wouldn't think you'd want to leave on Wednesday.
I'm not sure how. Yeah, we'll have to. I'll have to look at it.
Yeah, take a look at that.
Yeah.
I will be flying over Sunday, the 20th.
Okay.
And leaving Thursday morning, the 24th.
Okay.
So we're right on the date of the
That's my timing.
Yeah.
Too.
So,
say that again.
I'm gonna fly over on the 20th.
Sunday the 20th.
And. Return on Thursday morning, the 24th. And that's going from memory, so I make no promises.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds about right.
That's.
I'm looking at my calendar.
So I wanted to double check.
That's what I'm doing. That's the best time frame.
So I guess I need to.
So you think the night of the 23rd is a banquet?
I do.
It's the. I think that's the...
I thought it was a luncheon, so... Okay.
Well, there's a luncheon as well with award presentations, okay. But the banquet is... And they usually have they have live music and have... Yeah, it's...
Night of the 23rd. Yes. So we wouldn't come home until the 24th.
I wouldn't think so.
Okay. Yeah.
Commissioner McKenna?
I would like to get on the same schedule as the fly-in group on the fly-in the 20th and the 20th and fly out the 24th.
Nothing really starts until late on the 20th, right?
Yeah, right.
I'm driving. We're driving.
I'm driving, too.
And Commissioner Congdon, I have airfare for you.
To Boise. Oh, I was thinking of Spokane. I'm sorry. I just No, I'm flying. You're right. To Boise.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Feeling better.
I jumped to Spokane really quickly there.
Commissioner Bowles, are you driving?
Flying. And I've made my own arrangements, and I'll get those to you.
Okay. Commissioner McKenna, will you fly or drive?
I'm going to fly.
Okay. Commissioner Smith is driving.
Right.
Okay.
Glad to see you all attending. That's awesome.
The whole group.
Now, is Gary going or not going?
He is going.
You had him crossed off there, so I...
The cross off is...
The hotel?
I booked all your rooms.
Okay.
Then he was unable to attend, so I canceled his room. And now his other plans changed, and he's attending.
Oh, okay.
Although he is staying at another hotel.
Are you enjoying this job yet?
It's my favorite. I get flowers.
Now you know why.
I get flowers. Thank you, by the way.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
At least it was from commissioners and not from the person who held the position last for taking it.
It's not sympathy flowers. There were flowers of support.
Appreciation.
And gratitude.
Condolences.
Yeah, condolences.
Okay, so thank you very much. I'll make those updates. And so May 10th, I have Commissioners Arsenault, Bowles, and Congdon attending the telecom workshop.
That is, Lisa, that's 9 and 10, right?
Yes.
Starts at noon on the 9th and goes until noon on the 10th?
Yeah. Staying one night on the
9th. Are you all going over that morning?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just driving.
Yep.
Okay. And... June 15th in New Orleans, APPA, everyone attending except Commissioner Congdon. I have hotel rooms. We'll probably need to confirm those again. I don't have anyone's airfare to verify that, but looks like I've changed a couple.
I've got my reservation. I'll send it to you so you see it.
Thank you. That's
helpful. We've been holding off because there was a family event, and we finally got that figured out.
Okay.
So I'll do the airlines thing and then get information. Thank you.
Okay. And then I can help you work on the alternate travel forms also if we need those. Okay. Then Commissioner Congdon is traveling to Olympia in June for the Water Committee.
Flying?
Yes.
Yeah, you've got me.
Yes, you are. Yeah. You're also renting a car.
Yes. Thank you.
And July Waputa meetings in Chehalis, except Commissioner Congdon. And I have rooms held. I think we'll be okay on determining check-in and check-out for a while. Unless you know already which days.
That's a long drive. That when it starts at noon normally, it'd still be makeable by driving Wednesday.
It'd be about 5 hours. Yeah, four and
four,
a half.
Four and a half, yeah.
Really? I was going to say six.
No. For you, it would be six.
Well, it would be.
That's right.
Six and a half for me.
No. Start point's a little different.
Yeah.
Commissioner Smith, APPA policymakers, have you?
I haven't done anything, and due to a couple of wedding receptions, I'm rethinking whether or not I will be there. So,
okay,
get back to you.
I'll just put a question mark there.
Yeah.
Then into September, we have WAPUTA meetings in Pasco, rooms held at the Red Lion. And then WAPUTA workshop, water workshop.
Lisa, can I jump in for a second?
Of course.
Back to Pasco. I will be attending, and I will be driving, just to let you know.
Thank you.
I won't be attending Pasco.
Okay. Thank you.
I will be attending the water workshop.
Yeah, and I will be attending Pasco, so just so you know.
Yep.
Okay. Are you, Commissioner Smith, also, I have you listed for the water workshop as well.
Giving the opening remarks.
Well, this is not in Leavenworth. It's not in Leavenworth, so.
I'm teasing you.
I'm the VP, not the president.
So that means, no, you're probably not attending.
No, I probably am because I'm one of the officers now. Yeah. I've made a commitment to go to more activities than I have. So, right. Yeah.
Well, I'll leave you there. Yeah. Okay. Commissioner Smith, the budget committee meeting for WAPUTA in October.
Yep.
Do you want a room at the DoubleTree Town Place?
Between the two of them, whichever is less expensive.
Okay.
For the night before.
Just the 17th only. Okay, and we have rooms held for the November WAPUTA meetings and Olympia December annual conference. I haven't seen a location yet.
What are the dates on that? What are the November dates? I somehow didn't get that.
14th through 16th.
That's what I thought. Okay.
In November, that's always just the WAPUTA headquarters.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Olympia.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So, but we don't know on the annual yet.
I haven't seen anything.
No, I haven't heard anything either.
Tulalip, that's what I've been told.
I've heard that, but I haven't seen it in public.
I mean, not official, but I was told it was Tulalip. Actually, Carol told me that.
Okay. I'll watch for it.
Oh, that's a good source.
Okay, are we missing anything?
We'll find out.
Yeah, well, I don't want to find out after.
Good.
Oh, I need to remember to do my alternate travel form, too, for the voyage trip.
Yeah, I started working on that today.
Good. You are ahead of me, as usual. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Let me know if I can help with anything.
Thanks, Lisa.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything else with Commissioner? I'm sorry. Gary?
Lisa, my alternate travel forms for the Boise trip as well. I'll need to send you something on that.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. 13, delegation of action items.
So we had three from the last meeting. Two of them you saw, one of them you saw today. So the training issue, Rich Hyatt reported on that. The climate change forecast, the Tri-Commission, Jeff Smith has taken care of that. And actually, on the third item, on the updating the climate change forecast for distribution loads, I think we have a little bit of a difference of perspective about what the request was. So I just asked Sean Seaman to talk to Commissioner Arso to make sure we're producing the right thing. So, Gary, you should hear from him at some point here. We were thinking you were in today, and I forgot that you were not, so he'll be getting back to you.
Okay, thank you.
And that's it.
Okay, 14. Delegation of action items.
So we've got a few for Janet Jaspers. The will the flows this year create risk for flooding in the parks? The how we're managing total dissolved gas with higher flows. And more than 30-year data for the water supply forecast.
And Steve, I'll jump in here. And on the how we're managing gas issues, total gas numbers, if there has been any legislation or proposed legislation or it wouldn't be legislation, it would come from regulatory ecology in terms of those numbers.
Right. And I think there's a request for us just to see if we can do something on the monitor LUD and lessons learned on that. Is that, do I have that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's what start. I got. Miss. Yeah. Am I missing anything?
Yeah, I think we're good. Okay. I would ask for additional public comment, but there's no public present. So I think we can go to 16. That is a general business. Come before the commission again. No one present. Executive session. Could you give me an estimated time?
2 hours.
Oh, okay.
You're brutal.
That's not how many questions, yeah.
We will be moving into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or likely to become a party and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101I, and to consider the selection of a site or acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause a likelihood of increased price as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101B for approximately 2 hours. And we will go into session and we'll try and come out by 3:30.
Binley.
Anything else? Okay. The executive session will open shortly.
It is now 3:42. We're coming back into session. No votes were taken during executive session. No decisions were made. Is there any further public comment? None being said, we are adjourned.